Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to Sound with John Schaefer. You're listening to Soundcheck. You're listening to Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you were watching the Grammys this past Sunday, maybe you were wondering why the list of nominees for Song of the Year was so long. Not that there were more than five contenders, but some of those contenders had multiple names that you've probably never heard of. See, Song of the Year is an award not for performers, they get Record of the Year, but for songwriters. So take Kelly Clarkson's Stronger, for example. That was credited to four different songwriters, and then they had to mention Kelly Clarkson's name just in case you forgot what song they were talking about. We've been seeing a lot of this in pop music lately. Songwriting credits have gotten to be really complicated. A hit song can have one person writing lyrics, one person creating beats, another person doing a melody, and sometimes someone else finding a sample to build the song around. So you can end up with a whole committee of people writing one song. Take this top 10 hit by Flo Rida from 2009. Sugar by Flo Rida is built around an earlier song that you may recognize. The band Eiffel 65 had a big hit back in the late 90s with this little piece of Europop and its nonsense lyrics. The song was called Blue, and it was written by the three members of this Italian band. Now, back to Flo Rida's Sugar. Well, obviously, you have to credit Flo Rida for the new words, and the songwriting team, known as the Jackie Boys, for whatever else they added to the original sample. Now we're up to six people for this one song, and we still haven't talked about who wrote the actual melody that the female singer is doing. Well, that singer is Winter Gordon, and she wrote that melody. It was actually just a demo vocal that the producers liked enough to keep. So Winter may be just one of seven people who had a hand in this song, but obviously she had a big role to play in it. Now to me, the idea of creating art by committee sounds like a great way to produce not-so-great art. So I'm glad to see that Winter Gordon is now writing and singing on her own, and she will join us later for a live performance. Also, speaking of the Grammys, we'll talk with the author of that big cover story on dual Grammy winner Frank Ocean that came out in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. But first,
and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness. Did you know how much I love you?
The late Johnny Cash will forever be a part of American culture, or at least for as long as we use postage stamps. The U.S. Postal Service has announced it will issue a commemorative stamp in its Music Icons series honoring Johnny Cash, and it'll be one of those so-called forever stamps, meaning that in 100 years, when a letter costs a gazillion dollars to mail, your stamp that you paid 46 cents for will still be valid for a first-class letter. Joining me on the line from Virginia is Greg Breeding, who was the art director and designer of the new Johnny Cash stamp. Greg, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. It's great to be with you.
So art director and designer, does that mean something different when you're talking about a postage stamp?
It does. And the biggest difference, of course, is that in the world of graphic design, we are creating images for websites and posters and magazines. But a stamp means you have to reduce all of that, characters even like Johnny Cash, down to a simple stamp, and that becomes an entirely new process.
So is this something that's assigned to you by the Postal Service?
It is, and while there are four other art directors like me on contract with the Postal Service, each of us receive assignments from the creative director.
Mm-hmm.
I joke that we fight for the assignments, but in truth, we're not really fighting. We're very collegial. We work together. But, of course, some assignments like Johnny Cash are the ones that everyone wants.
So are you the go-to guy for musicians on stamps?
Oh, not at all. all of us are music fans, and arguably I might be the least qualified for some music stamps, but the way I made my case was because of my childhood experiences with Johnny Cash.
Really?
Yeah, my dad was particularly a fan, and in fact, I was born in 1963. That's the same year that Frank Bez photographed Johnny Cash for the image that we're actually using on the stamp.
Hmm.
And so when I was just 6 or 7 years old, my dad would play Johnny Cash albums on our stereo. And to tell you the truth, John, I was afraid of Johnny Cash. He was a scary figure to me.
Well, he was the Man in Black, right?
That's right. That only worsened, you know, in the late 60s. He got a television show,
right.
And my dad and I would watch that, too, and I found him terrifying.
We've received a lot of letters or requests for the old songs. Most of them deal with love, love for that special someone who at one time or another was the sun, the moon, and the stars in your own little corner of heaven. I'll take you home again, Kathleen.
So, in fact, the stamp, which is beautiful, is also very kind of high contrast play of light and dark. Was that part of the intent?
Yes, and that played into the choice of the image quite a bit. I mean, for one thing, of course, trying to find an image of Johnny Cash that sums up his entire career, not to mention his larger-than-life persona, was an enormous challenge. But that photograph culminates during a period where he was performing for prisoners and he was about to do crossover work. It sort of is, at least from a point of view of his career, a very poignant moment.
Now, Greg, I have to ask, were you listening to Ring of Fire at the time you were putting all this stuff together?
I was. Actually, what my favorites were his two live albums, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison,
mm-hmm,
and Johnny Cash at San Quentin. Because I just love live albums anyway, and there's such energy in the room on both of those albums.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone.
And even as a little boy, my dad had him. I was afraid of, but fascinated by, him performing in front of prisoners. And of course, as I grew up, I began to respect him for what he was actually trying to do. You know, The Man in Black is a song he wrote, too.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he describes his heart for the prisoners, for the lonely, for the destitute. And so my fear turned into awe.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time.
We're speaking with Greg Breeding. He's the art director and designer of the new Johnny Cash commemorative postage stamp from the Postal Service. This year actually marks the 10th anniversary of Johnny Cash's death. Greg, it's part of a larger music icons series of stamps. The first one was the Tejano musician Lydia Mendoza, one of the pioneers of the Tejano music style. Are you privy to how the musicians are chosen and how Johnny Cash was chosen?
I am in the big picture. You know, the American public submit over 40,000 suggestions to the Postal Service every year for stamp subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a committee called the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee, all comprised of American citizens, not government employees, and they weed through all of those suggestions. And then they take about 20 of their recommendations to the Postmaster General for approval. And once all that's done, the assignments are made to the art directors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easy to say that Johnny Cash has been someone for a long time that's received a lot of petitions to be on a stamp. So
it was his time.
It was his time. And what's interesting to me is the thing that I love about stamps the most is that the Postal Service does the job of selecting, you know, what is good about our culture, things that are worth remembering and celebrating. And so the Music Icon series becomes a way for the Postal Service to acknowledge the great performers in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just began developing this series this year, the first two of which, as you said, are Lydia Mendoza and Johnny Cash.
But this is not your first music-themed stamp. You worked on the Miles Davis and Edith Piaf stamps, which were released as a kind of a matched set last year, right?
That's right. There have been obviously quite a few stamps in the past designed for the American public, the most popular of which in the 80s, I believe, maybe it was the 90s, it was Elvis Presley.
Right.
And last year, the stamp I designed for Miles Davis and Edith Piaf was actually a joint issue between the American Postal Service and the French La Poste.
Mm-hmm. So the same stamps, but with different, with euros in France and cents here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Apparently, Edith Piaf was quite popular in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, Miles Davis was knighted in France. So there was a special relationship there. So even though that was a really exciting project, it did not fit into the Music Icon series, which is brand new. So hopefully, John, you'll be able to see three releases of Music Icon series for years to come.
Mm.
That's my hope.
All right. Well, there are, Greg, lots of, you know, cuts being made to the Postal Service, the announcement that they're not going to do Saturday deliveries anymore. They've been hemorrhaging money in an age when people do so much of their business electronically. Is there a concern that the budget for these really beautiful and artistic stamps, as opposed to purely utilitarian ones, might be in some jeopardy?
I think that's legitimate to ask. I have not been aware of those cuts on the stamps yet, I think for a couple of reasons. For one thing, while first-class mail is in decline, which is to say people are, in fact, using stamps to send their mail less often, the Postal Service is actually enjoying growth in delivering packages. And so I think the bulk of the revenue for the Postal Service in the future will come there. However, there is this sort of cultural commitment that the Postal Service has that I'm enjoying, and that is, of course, even while letter writing is on the decline, the commitment to creating stamps that honor the United States and our culture and the people and places within it is continuing to be high.
And stamp collecting? I mean, collectors really go for, you know, stamps that have a striking design to them, as this Johnny Cash stamp does.
Yeah, the collectors are very faithful to the stamp program because they, of course, love stamps for the sake of the stamps themselves in many cases. But one of the things that we're hoping to do with the Music Icon series is to create new interest in stamp collecting and just stamps themselves by putting, you know, more popular subjects, more popular icons like Johnny Cash out into the mainstream.
Mm.
So that's definitely an intentional move, the one that really honors what they've always been about, because Johnny Cash is certainly worthy to be on a stamp. He was a living American icon.
And not only that, but he's on a forever stamp.
which now costs 46 cents. So it's Johnny Cash Forever,
That's right.
Courtesy of the U.S. Postal Service. Available starting on June 6th of this year. You can see a picture of the stamp on our website, soundcheck.org. We've been speaking with Greg Breeding. He's the art director and designer behind the new Johnny Cash commemorative stamp. And Greg, beautiful job. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed it.
This is Soundcheck.
The first time ever I saw your face.
That's Johnny Cash's version of The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, part of his musical legacy. But another part of Johnny Cash's legacy was The List. The List was just what it sounds like, a list of 100 essential songs that Johnny Cash passed down to his daughter, the singer, songwriter, and guitarist Roseanne Cash, which he said, you know, these are songs you need to know. And in September of 2009, Roseanne Cash and her band came to a soundcheck performance in the Green Space, our ground floor performance venue, to perform some of the songs from that list. Here is Roseanne Cash, recorded live on soundcheck in the Green Space, performing Long Black Veil.
Ten years ago, on a cold, dark night, there was someone killed neath the town hall light. There were few at the scene, but they all did agree that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me. The judge said, "Son, what is your alibi? If you were somewhere else, then you won't have to die." I spoke not a word, though it meant my life, for I'd been in the arms of my best friend's wife. She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. The scaffold is high, an eternity near. She stood in a crowd and shed not a tear. But sometimes at night, when the cold wind moans in a long black veil, she cries o'er my bones. She walks these hills in a long, the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me.
Long Black Veil, a song from Johnny Cash's List, left to his daughter Roseanne Cash and performed by Roseanne on soundcheck in a 2009 performance from the Green Space. Join us at 2 p.m. tomorrow on soundcheck.org to hear indie rock favorites Yola Tengo recording their session for us. They'll play songs from the new album called Fade. And then, of course, you'll be able to hear it tomorrow night at 9 p.m.
Who's your
Up next, a live performance in our studio from the New York-based singer Winter Gordon. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. New York native Winter Gordon got her start writing hits for stars like Flo Rida, Mary J. Blige, and Danity Kane. But it was this 2010 song, Dirty Talk, that jump-started her solo career. Now she's in the middle of a series of self-released EPs. They're all thematically related. The latest is called Sanguine. Winter and her band are here today. Let's hear a song. It's Winter Gordon with Stimella live on Soundcheck.
Life is one big hypocrite, like a knife against the skin. I'm held hostage in this skin. Gotta help the weak ones win, so I'm running. I am running. Save me with your powers. Shower me with your wisdom.
That is Winter Gordon and her band live in the Soundcheck studio with a song called Stimela, which features Winter singing with Sam Burke at our piano, Arthur Fleischman on bass, Elias Logothetis playing the percussion, the cajon, and Luke Duffy on guitar. Winter, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hello.
So Stimela, that word has appeared in a couple of different places. There's an African band by that name. And then there's Hugh Masekela. The South African trumpeter wrote that anti-apartheid song.
Yes, he did.
So was that the inspiration
yes,
for the
that's
title?
Actually where the hook part of the song comes from.
And what does the word mean?
Stimela means train.
Train?
Yeah. Stimela means train in Zulu.
Okay. I mean, it's just a song. It seems full of regret. It's a beautiful song,
full
but
of
the
regret.
Lyrics are, you know, I sold out, I sold my soul.
Yeah.
So this is not from the new EP, Sanguine. This is from the first one.
It's a series called The Human Condition.
Right.
And Sanguine is the second one. Delea was the first EP from the series. And each EP is a different emotion. And it's kind of where I was feeling in my life. Mm. And Stimela is from Delea, which means pain.
Right.
And I was feeling pretty regretful about a lot of things, hurt, a lot of family issues. And it was just coming out naturally in my music.
Mm-hmm.
And the song Stimela, I got the hook from Hugh Masekela. And I worked with him when I was in high school at LaGuardia.
Really?
Mm-hmm. We did a huge concert with him and Paul Simon at Carnegie Hall. I think he taught us like 20 songs.
Wow. So LaGuardia High School, for folks who are outside the New York City area, is this big performing arts high school.
Yeah.
That's not where you started singing, though, is it? Were you singing at home before that?
I sang in church. Mm-hmm. I sang on street corners. Like, my parents would like make me use a boombox to preach the gospel.
Really?
Yeah.
So you grew up in a religious family.
Yeah.
And here in New York.
Mm-hmm. Queens.
In Queens.
South Jamaica, Queens. Yeah.
Okay. So Winter Gordon's here with us in the Soundcheck studio with her band. So, you know, in the classic kind of the four temperaments, the four humors, there's sanguine, phlegmatic, melancholic, and what am I missing? Choleric. But it seems like you were going for like four different emotional states, right?
Well, I wanted four different emotional. I'm thinking the last one is kind of like love and lust and something else. It comes naturally, actually. Like, I don't have the title until pretty much I finish each chapter and I know where I am. Like,
And it sounds like maybe this is a little bit of a different kind of sound for you. I mean, we heard a little bit of Dirty Talk, which was a huge dance floor hit, and 13 million YouTube views later.
I mean, I had a whole dance era period in my life, and that allowed for me to do what I'm doing now.
Right.
You know, allowed me to make money and kind of just break away and do some of the music that I kind of felt innate to do right now.
So you're self-releasing these EPs.
Yeah, for free.
Mm-hmm. For free?
For free.
Okay.
Free.
You know, the dance music, working with Mary J. Blige, Flo Rida and stuff, did that kind of give you the foundation to actually take on a big project like this that spans time and four EPs and big ideas and stuff like that?
I don't know if that any of my like writing with other people was kind of the foundation for this. I love to write music and it just happens naturally. And writing for other people was just something I did.
Hmm.
I mean, it was a great part of my life, but I didn't really need anybody else to do it.
And does it happen? I mean, when you say it happens naturally, do you think ahead of time, all right, for this album, I'm going to go for this kind of sound? Or is it the kind of thing where you don't know what it's going to sound like until it comes out?
I don't know. I don't know what it's going to sound like. I go into the studio and I hear a melody in my head. And I say to whoever the musician is I'm working with, I tap it out sometimes. And I'm like, can you play this? I just hear the sound. Play it. And sometimes I can't go to sleep because I hear it so much in my head.
So Sanguine is the second of the four EPs. Deleo was the first. So Deleo, you said, was about like pain.
Pain.
And what is this one about? What's the theme?
Optimism. I feel like I have nothing but choices in front of me. It's all up to me at this point. You know, I'm an indie artist. I'm really pushing myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no label behind me. I'm making all the decisions on the songs. And I'm doing all the visuals and everything, so I'm optimistic.
All right. You're one of the lucky ones.
Hey, I am.
And that happens to be the title of this next song you're going to do for us.
I wrote this one for my little nephew. He's 2, and he's like a huge source of happiness in my life.
All right. Let's hear the song called Lucky Ones. It's from the second of the 4 EPs in this series that Winter Gordon is doing. And she and her band are here with us in the Soundcheck studio to play this song for us. Again, the new EP is called Sanguine, and it's Winter Gordon and the band live on Soundcheck. Lucky Ones is from the new EP by Winter Gordon, but you just heard it live here in the Soundcheck studio, played by Winter and her band. They're performing for us here today, and the next song is also from this new EP, Sanguine. It's called Tomorrow, and here once again with her band is Winter Gordon. Thank you.
sky fall down, let tomorrow come under the burning sun, a place that we come home. Don't turn away from me. I want you to look me in these eyes and don't play the fool with me. I see through you in the darkest light, so don't turn away. No, 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 I'll be here waiting. No, don't turn away. No, 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 I'll be here under
Once again, that's Winter Gordon and her band live on Soundcheck with her song Tomorrow. That appears on the second of her four Human Condition EPs. The four-part series began with Duleo, which, Winter, you said before was about sort of pain.
Pain.
Sanguine is about hope. The fourth one, you're thinking, would probably be Love and Lust. Any ideas for the third yet?
Well, there's love and lust, two different parts.
Ah, okay.
But right now, I'm, like, in a vibe, and I'm just figuring it out because I'm in the studio. I just started last week recording the next part.
Hmm. And you're releasing these, as you said before, for free. And folks can find a link to Winter's band page on our website, soundcheck.org. You can get the first two EPs in this series for free. Last year, you reported on Fashion Week here in New York, right?
I do some blogging.
Yeah. So you're a big fashionista?
I like to think so. I'm I like to thrift a lot.
Uh huh.
Are you a thrifter?
I'm wearing Old Navy and Fruit of the Loom. So
that's cool.
That's as far as my fashion sense goes.
Oh, that's cool. I like to pick up things that I like. I like to think of fashion more in style than what you're wearing or how much it costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, thrifting has become, like, you know, a big thing now.
But I mean, like, real thrifting. Like, real hardcore thrifting. I've been thrifting since I was a little kid.
So not like Macklemore with...
No, out of necessity.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, you said before you're doing all the visuals for this, mm-hmm. this series as well. Does that include things like artwork and design and all that kind of stuff?
I just recently, not even recently, like over the past 6 months, been really getting into art and the art world and meeting a lot of street artists. Like there's a big group called Street Savvy, mm-hmm. and I've been hanging with them a lot and just getting to know the art world. I've been going to a lot of galleries and museums and appreciating it. I'm working with Housing Works, actually, mm-hmm. and I'm curating the windows. And it really inspired me to get some street artists into the curation of Housing Works.
So is this the Housing Works that's on, where is that? On, is it Mercer Street?
Hell's Kitchen and Chelsea.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if people walk by Housing Works there, mm-hmm. you're responsible for the windows.
I am.
Okay.
I'm responsible. So if you like it, say something. Go in. Leave a note.
All right. Winter Gordon, a woman of many talents. She's in the middle of this four-part series of EPs on the human condition. The second one, Sanguine, is the latest. It's out now. And Winter, this has been fun having you and the band here with us in the studio today. Thanks so much.
It has been fun. And thanks to my band. I love you guys.
Nice job, guys. This is Soundcheck. The singer Frank Ocean was nominated for 6 Grammy Awards and walked away with just 2. We'll talk about his award tally and Frank Ocean's underwhelming performance at the ceremony in just a moment. This is Soundcheck.
Picking up the pieces of another life. There is nothing left to hide.
Soundcheck.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week, we spoke with New York Times pop music critic John Caramonica about his Grammy predictions. And when it came to Album of the Year, he had this to say.
I would love if Frank won, but my feeling is one of these less good rock bands will win.
Frank, of course, being the R&B singer Frank Ocean, who in fact did not win the Grammy for Album of the Year. Mumford & Sons took that prize. He also didn't win Best New Artist or Record of the Year. In fact, of his 6 possible Grammys, he walked away with 2. One for Best Urban Contemporary Album and Best Rap Song Collaboration. And he gave a rather interesting performance. Jeff Himmelman recently wrote about Frank Ocean for the New York Times Magazine. He joins me now on the line from Washington, D.C. Jeff, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's talk about his performance. You mentioned at one point in your piece for the New York Times Magazine that Frank Ocean agreed to perform at the Grammys only if he could choose the song. Is that right?
That is correct. And he made that very clear, and his managers made that very clear also. That was indeed the case.
Now, did you get a sense that there were any nerves involved? Because to me, he seemed kind of nervous out there.
So, you know, when we spoke about his performance in advance, I knew ahead of time it was not allowed to reveal that he was going to be singing Forrest Gump at the awards ceremony, and they were going through that negotiation with Grammy people while I was out there. And at the time, his logic made a lot of sense. He just thought it was a more joyous song to sing. I think the Grammy people were more interested in having him do one of the bigger ballads off the record.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to do Forrest Gump because he thought that was more reflective of where he was in his life. And then, sort of mysteriously to me, he kind of turned it into this piano dirge with no percussion to speak of, and kind of lost his way a little bit halfway through the song, I felt. And I definitely perceived some nerves, too, which is surprising to me because he projects such confidence when I was with him.
Mm-hmm. Although you did sort of indicate elsewhere in the piece that in Frank Ocean's remarkable arsenal of musical talents, live performance is still pretty much a work in progress.
That's right. I mean, he has played, I think, I don't know what the exact number is, but it's maybe 20 shows, 25 shows in his entire life. And you look at some of the other performances that were at the awards ceremony. And I mean, these are people who've played thousands of shows, and you could tell.
Yeah.
And I think for Frank, he's an unbelievably precise and deep recording artist. I think getting his live confidence up is going to be a real task for him. And I think on Sunday night, that was a pretty clear example of the fact that he still has a way to go there.
So we're talking about Frank Ocean's performance of Forrest Gump, featuring one of the more memorable whistling solos in Grammy history.
That's true. I actually quite like that part. And I thought the visuals were stunning.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a great concept, and I know they put a lot of work into trying to make that come off. I think maybe he had some sound problems on the stage, or I don't know what it was, but it was very clear that he was having a hard time keeping track of the melody about halfway through the song.
Let's hear a little bit from Frank Ocean's performance at this weekend's Grammys.
And this is love, I know it's true. I won't forget you.
That is Forrest Gump, the song, performed live at the Grammys by Frank Ocean, who was nominated for 6 awards, including most of the big ones, ended up walking off with 2 Grammys, Best Urban Contemporary Album and Best Rap Song Collaboration for the song No Church in the Wild with Jay-Z and Kanye West. We're speaking with Jeff Himmelman, who wrote the cover story on Frank Ocean for last weekend's New York Times Magazine. And Jeff, you know, Frank Ocean, very much a critical darling. His album Channel Orange did get very close to the top of the Billboard charts, but he's hardly been on the radio. Would you guess that for the majority of viewers on Sunday night that this was their kind of real introduction to Frank Ocean?
I think it probably was. I think in some ways, even though the album has been so critically acclaimed, I think, you know, there are a lot of people who, when the article came out last weekend, really didn't know who he was. And I think that was true of the Grammy viewership as well. If you watch the promos for the show, they didn't really mention him until late in the game. He performed quite late. But it was very clear that they were focused on other people. And Frank was made very clear to me and has made very clear to others that radio was not really his goal with this record. And anybody who's listened to it can tell that, even though some of the more obvious single selections are about subject matter that can never be on the radio.
Right.
And he released a 9-minute, 53-second song, Pyramids, as the second single off the record, which is obviously unplayable on the radio for the most part. So he didn't actively court that audience. One song off the record, Thinking About You, was released as a single and actually has been on the Billboard charts for a long time, and that's the one that most people know if they know anything.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears, but boy, they pour when I'm thinking about you. Oh, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. You, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still? Do you, do you? Or do you not think so far ahead?
But by and large, unless you're a real music fan, Frank Ocean's kind of snuck up on you.
Yeah. And he's done it kind of on his own terms. You know, the book on becoming a pop star is you want to be marketable, you want to be likable. And
that's right.
One of the things you write about in your piece, you quote him as saying, I have no delusions about my likability in every scenario. I know that in order to get things done the way you want them, oftentimes your position will be unpopular.
That's right.
Is he a prickly sort of guy?
He, what's interesting is that he's one of the nicest, most courteous people you'll meet, right? So he has his mind set on the way he wants to do something. So he's not aggressive or unkind. He was perfectly courteous with me. It's just it was very clear what we were going to talk about and what we weren't going to talk about.
Right.
And I think that's more how he is. And, you know, I talked to the head of Def Jam about Frank, and he said, you know, with Frank, it's an hourly negotiation, a weekly negotiation. The quote actually didn't make the piece, but he was saying that they're constantly battling over things because Frank has it in his mind. And both his managers, Kelly and Chris Clancy, they both said, you know, we'll say this in front of him. He can be tough.
Yeah.
But he insists on what he wants as an artist. And in today's world, where you're buffeted by everything from Twitter, instantaneous feedback, to radio, to labels, to all of that, if you can't chart your own course, I think it's pretty easy to get knocked off course. And I think the one thing Frank's been pretty successful at is charting his own course.
But as you sort of alluded to a moment ago, there are certain places he won't go. What was off limits for you when you were writing?
It was very clear that sort of a deeper discussion of his family, in particular his dad, was a very painful part of his past. His dad took off when he was little, and there's some animosity. There, I don't know if animosity is the right word, but definitely some hurt feelings. And Frank had taken to Twitter a couple weeks before I saw him to talk about a rumor that his dad was going to be suing him for $1 million, which I don't know where that came from or what became of it, because when I raised it with Frank, he basically just said, you know, we're not going to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
So he has area, and I also didn't go deeply into the sexuality question with him, because in a previous interview with GQ, he went into the fact that, you know, he doesn't want to put a label on himself by saying that he had been in love with a man when he was 19. A lot of people just assumed that meant that he was saying he was gay, and he has not been willing to say either I'm bisexual or I'm gay or what. He doesn't want to label himself, and I knew that, and so I stayed away from those conversations going in.
Now, he has a sort of unusual, almost ambiguous relationship with the industry itself. He was signed by one of the major record labels, Def Jam.
That's right.
And that did not turn out the way you would normally expect. You know, you sign to a record label, they put out an album. And
right.
That's not how it happened.
No, that's not how it happened. I mean, basically, the way he tells it, and Def Jam confirms this, is basically he got signed to a deal at the end of 2009 under his sort of born name. Is he was born Christopher Bro. His nickname was Lonnie, after his grandfather Lionel, and he was signed as Lonnie Bro in 2009. And so everybody in LA who knew him as a songwriter for other people knew him as Lonnie Bro. And he was signed as Lonnie Bro, and then Def Jam essentially just never gave him a recording budget. And so he went out and used his connections and his friends to find beats and basically make a record on the cheap, which he released as a free mixtape in February of 2011. And the mixtape is what blew up. And because it blew up and he had done it himself in a very almost defiant way, he was able to then control a lot more of his career than had that record come out as Lonnie Bro under Def Jam's auspices. He would be sitting in a very, very different and much less powerful position today.
How is his position today, given what happened on Sunday night at the Grammys?
I mean, he picked up two Grammys. They
yeah.
weren't the ones that I'm sure he had his heart set on. I think it's, you know, you can make a case that he really did make the album of the year. I mean, I think I would count myself in that camp. But, I mean, it's hard to fight Gotye as that record of the year, because that was an overpowering song. Def Jam was hoping that he would win album of the year and it would become kind of a coffee table record, as Barry Weiss put it to me. And I don't think that happened. To people who didn't know who he was or understand what he was about, I don't think he provided much of a clue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, short term that may not be great for him, but I think long term he's in a very good position. I think there's so much respect in the industry for what he is capable of doing in a studio.
So a young man still with a lot of untapped potential there.
I think so, and I hope he goes forward. And I mean, he's a very, very hardworking guy, and that much was clear to me immediately, and I don't see any reason why that's going to cease. And so I can guarantee you that he's going to solve these performance issues and anything else that's out there, because that's what his mindset is.
We've been speaking with Jeff Himmelman, the musician, journalist, and author of the cover story on Frank Ocean for last weekend's New York Times Magazine. Jeff, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Soundcheck.
Forrest Gump, I know you're Forrest.
Tell us what you think of Frank Ocean. Were you disappointed by his showing at the Grammys? Do you think he's overrated? Leave a comment on our site at soundcheck.org. In our weekly Check Ahead feature, we offer you a preview of an upcoming album. This week, Visit the site to stream music by Lady Lamb the Beekeeper. That's the stage name of Allie Spaltrow, a singer from Maine originally, who has found a home in Brooklyn. Her new album is called Ripely Pine, and you'll hear her perform on the show later this month. But for the moment, here's a sample from her album. This song is called Aubergine.
Aubergine, she's on my bed now. Oh, no.
Lady Lamb the Beekeeper from her album Ripely Pine and a song called Aubergine. The entire album is streaming on our website as our weekly Check Ahead feature. Go to soundcheck.org to hear more from this talented singer-songwriter. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, celebrate Valentine's Day with Soundcheck and Yola Tengo. The legendary indie band performs songs from their new album Fade. Plus, we talk with the author of a darkly funny new novel called The Love Song of Johnny Valentine, about a tween pop star struggling with the realities of fame and the music biz. I'm John Schaefer. See you back here tomorrow night at 9 for another Soundcheck.